Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekday mornings at 9 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller, and I'm glad you're listening in this morning because I think you're going to find this conversation interesting. A few years ago, the writer Curtis Sittenfeld was asked about why our high school experience looms so large in our lives. Her debut novel, Prep, was about a private boarding school in the Northeast. She mused about how time and maturity change our perceptions of the way people behaved in those fraught years. And then she added this: that feels like really rich subject matter, and it's strange but interesting to think how the 2016 election can put something that happened years ago in a different light. Ms. Sittenfeld has delved into that rich subject matter, drawn from the 2016 presidential campaign, and asked, what if? What if Hillary Rodham had, instead of hitching her wagon to Bill Clinton's star, pursued a life as a legal scholar, a political activist, and eventually a U.S. senator? What if his infidelity, his political compromises, and his personal charisma hadn't been her burden to carry? Curtis Sittenfeld's new novel is titled Rodham. It's delicious. She joined me from her home here in the Twin Cities, where she's doing a mostly digital book tour. And I started by asking her what kinds of questions a novelist asks in such a strange moment. So I've been curious about, in a moment like this, how artists respond to it. And I'm wondering if you're asking yourself questions about how this may fit into some future writing that you're doing, that this moment we're in. I'm curious about the process of this for somebody who's taking in the world and trying to figure out what that means for their writing. So what have you been thinking about?
Well, I think that's a fascinating question that I feel like, for me personally, I don't know the answer to. I think a lot of fiction writers are feeling almost like, well, you know, why would I write fiction about the pandemic? And then they're also feeling like, but how could I not? And so it's this sort of confusing moment. And I'm very interested in sort of other creative people who are already incorporating this moment into their creativity or into their art. Like, for instance, the podcast Heavyweight that's hosted by Jonathan Goldstein, who's also a recently moved to the Twin Cities, and he's having these sort of certain like check-in episodes where people are like chatting, or even like the Saturday Night Lives from home, or like there's this series of essays like being published by the Swanee Review that are, I think they're called maybe something like the Coronavirus Chronicles. I might be getting the name kind of wrong, but people are just describing their daily life. And I'm actually struck as I read and consume these and find them often very moving. I think to myself, like, I do not metabolize an external event that quickly. And so I don't know the answer to the question that you're asking, but I myself do wonder it.
Yeah. Do you remember after 9/11, there was a lot of who will write the first post 9/11 novel? In some ways this feels like a burden and a weight as we live through history, right? Many of us, I guess, naturally turn then to people who do what you do to put it into some kind of context. And that feels like a lot, a burden.
Well, no, I do think that it's comparable. I mean, it's weird because, of course, you know, the pandemic is ongoing. And instead of being, you know, this sort of tragic event that happens very quickly. I mean, it's certainly tragic, but it's kind of, you know, spread out presumably over many months. And so I don't know. It's, I mean, I, in 2001, I was 26. I had just turned 26. And I had recently finished graduate school in Iowa. And I don't think I ever thought that I would write a 9/11 novel. Like, I just didn't feel like it was sort of my story. I mean, I was affected by it, and very aware of it, but it didn't seem like I, you know, was not a New Yorker. I did move to D.C. the next year, but you know, the pandemic is sort of everybody's story globally. So it's very confusing.
And when you say confusing, you mean what would I ultimately have to say about it?
Well, I mean, yeah. Everything about the pandemic is confusing. Like, the symptoms.
Yeah, know, just like, the science.
When
yeah.
it will end. Well, yeah, what isn't confusing? But in terms of, I mean, again, I don't think, like, I certainly would not write pandemic fiction for the sake of writing pandemic fiction. And one of the things
that's
kind of weird.
Wait, before you say that, why not?
Well, like, I wouldn't write it to sort of be timely, and I wouldn't, like, I think, I mean, I just, I feel really conscious of being so lucky to write fiction, and that writing fiction means I choose the imaginary world I live in. And so it's not to say I wouldn't write it, but I would need a good reason. Like, it's like, if the pandemic is everywhere around me, if I'm going to take it into my fictional universe and choose it, I think I have to justify that decision to myself.
Mm-hmm. How have you thought, though, about coming out with a novel in a moment when we are pretty consumed with what seems like a dystopian sort of world? And this is a novel that looks back in some ways to recent history.
Yeah.
But political recent history. I mean, I guess what I'm asking is, does this feel dissonant in some ways?
Well, I mean, I guess if you said to me, can you get to choose if your book comes out during a pandemic or not during a pandemic, I think I would say I choose not during a pandemic.
Yeah.
That's not really the choice. I mean, I could have delayed it, but it's like, delayed it for what, you know? And I think of myself, like, not only am I a writer, but I'm also a reader and like a viewer of TV shows and a, you know, listener of podcasts. And so I think right now, certainly I have an appetite for reading nonfiction about the pandemic, but I also have an appetite for reading both nonfiction and fiction about stuff that has nothing to do with the pandemic. Like, I don't want to consume all pandemic related, you know, writing and work all the time. So in that sense, I don't know, like, I feel like, you know, potentially the best experience of reading a novel, I think, is feeling really gripped by it, and it's really immersive, and you are plunged into this world and these lives that aren't your own. And I actually think, you know, for the right reader, I think Rodham can provide that. And I don't think it's ever the wrong time for that. You know, like, that's always the experience people want to have with a novel.
I'm really, really glad you described it like that, because I was talking about the novel with a friend over the weekend, and I said it was like tumbling into a space that in some ways kind of closed over me, and I felt for the first time, you know, I read a lot, but I felt for the first time that I was really removed from the angst of what we're living through. And that is exactly what I want from fiction.
I'm so happy to hear that, honestly, because I do feel that like that's what I want as a yeah. reader. And I think there's almost nothing, like, almost like it's almost a higher compliment for someone to say to me, like, almost, it's not I loved it, but like I couldn't put it down, or I couldn't stop thinking about it, or I just, you know, like I felt consumed. Like, it's not even an overt compliment, but it's like a very strongly implied one.
That's it. That's it. When I would have to put it down after a couple hours, I'd kind of come up for air. That doesn't happen very often. So so I'm glad to
wonderful.
Glad
thank
to,
you.
To hear that you've been thinking about that, too. So I was reading in preparing for our conversation. I was reading an interview that you did with Town and Country, a magazine that apparently your parents subscribed to. Is that right? I found that interesting.
In my youth.
You did this interview with them a couple years ago, and I don't know if you were actually working on Rodham at that point, but it was clear that you were starting to turn some interesting questions over in your mind, because you said to them, that feels like a real 2016 feels like a really rich subject matter. And it's strange but interesting to think how the 2016 election can put something that happened years ago in a different light. You'd been talking about, you know, how many of us can't live down our high school years, but you were also clearly still in a space of what happened in 2016. So, yeah. So I'm interested in what kinds of things you were hashing out in your mind at that point.
Okay, well, forgive me. What year did I give this interview? I gave
it 2018, just a couple years ago.
In 2018. Okay. So I think I probably was, I'm sure that I was writing Rodham, because I started Rodham in spring of 2017. I do think that, you know, almost like, well, I'll tell like a sort of weird story. I don't know if this is an answer. It's a short story, at least. But so there's, you know, I live in Minneapolis, and there's my sister's family came to visit from Rhode Island, and we ordered barbecue from a restaurant. Mm-hmm. And essentially, we accidentally brought home, I think it was like a tray of 5 pounds of pulled pork that we hadn't ordered, pounds is a lot of pulled pork. And so in the moment, we kind of thought I'll just tell the story, but I didn't try to take it back, because I was like, it's against the law. So I was like, okay, we just have a ton of pulled pork. This is in February of this year. So I start texting my neighbors and saying, like, want some pulled pork? And we have on our street, we have a family that has a bunch of kids. And so they, and we essentially, we gave like a little bit to one family and then all the rest to the family that has a lot of kids. And it just seemed like this kind of funny, like, pulled pork has fallen from the sky, and it's, you know, it's delicious if you're not a vegetarian, which obviously I sometimes aspire to be, but I'm not successful. Okay, so then I get my next credit card statement, and I see that I have been charged $90 for the pulled pork. So they accidentally gave it to me, but then they charged whatever the other you know, people who presumably meant to buy it would have paid. And so then I thought, like, oh, this isn't quite as fun. Like, this is not free pulled pork. Like, I didn't mean to kind of. So then it was almost like the same thing looked different. But then when all this happened, so I called the restaurant, I explained exactly what had happened. They said, okay, we'll refund it to your credit card. And then I got a phone message of where the person said, I just need one more piece of information, and then we'll, like, you know, refund it. And that message was left for me right around the time of the sort of shutdown or quarantine. And so then I thought to myself, it's very plausible this restaurant will cease to exist. And almost like I did in fact get the pulled pork. Why not just like pay for it? Like don't try to squeeze money out of an ailing restaurant. So to me, it's just like a very weird illustration of how literally the sequence of events that made me accidentally bring home 5 pounds of pulled pork are the same, but like my perspective of it has already changed twice.
I get it. Yeah. No, different meaning is attached when you have a little bit of distance from the experience. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. And just like the other, you know, like, is this a story about, you know, being charged for something I didn't really want? Or is this a story about, like, supporting, you know, a restaurant in the community that I hope will still exist after, you know, we all emerge from our, like, dwellings? And I don't know what it's a story about, but I feel conscious of that in so many ways. I mean, even to see Donald Trump in a movie now or like on TV from the years before, you know, he took office, it's a very different experience than it, you know, to see him in Home Alone or something. I think maybe it's Home Alone 2, but then it would have been, you know, at the time, even though those moments on screen are no different themselves, but the meaning attached to them is completely different.
Yeah, our perception is freighted with everything that we know. There's really no going back, is there?
Right, I agree.
Yeah. So on the night that Hillary Clinton was losing to Donald Trump, she's quoted by the New York Times as saying, "I knew it. I knew this would happen to me. They were never going to let me be president." And I've thought about that so many times.
Yeah, I have too.
You have too?
I have too, yeah.
Okay, so now tell me how your immediate perception of what she was saying has been influenced by what you, who you are now and who she is now and all the time that's passed. How do you think that's changed?
Prior to the 2016 election, because I had written a novel called American Wife that came out in 2008 and was a fictional retelling of the life of Laura Bush, I would be invited by publications to write essays about Hillary and sort of, you know, about the election and about what she quote unquote means or symbolizes. And I would decline because I felt like so much had been written about Hillary over almost 30 years analyzing her that I didn't really have anything original to say. And then I was invited by an editor at Esquire magazine to write a short story from Hillary's perspective when she was accepting the Democratic nomination for president. And I was kind of on the fence about doing it. And then I thought, oh, like, I think it's kind of intriguing. And this is in like maybe February 2016. And so I did it. And then it was like flipping that perspective and thinking, not what does Hillary look like to the American people, but what do the American people look like to Hillary? Like, that was a really interesting question to me. And I felt like I had a turnout 400 pages worth of things to say about it. But so even now, like, I struggle to answer the question that you're asking, which is, I mean, I...
No, but here, like, hold on. I think you're struggling because you think I want some kind of political analysis. I really don't. I'm curious that having done what you did, you said you flipped the perspective. That's what I'm asking, is now when you think about what she said that night, having done what having gotten into this character, this fictional character's head, Hillary Rodham, what does that sound like to you? They were never, I knew it, I knew this would happen to me, they were never going to let me be president.
Well, I mean, there's two things, I guess, that I would say. One would be that I do feel like after the fact, so many things feel inevitable. And like, I think there is a parallel universe where like she was elected and you know what I mean? And she doesn't feel that way or something, which might sound kind of ridiculous or like, you know, cold comfort to Democrats, including me. But the other thing, I mean, when you like people, I don't know, it's almost like as if it's obligatory to say when talking about Hillary that she's polarizing, which even that in itself, I don't love the description of her as polarizing, but it's very frequent. We sort of all know this, and this is in the air that we breathe, but the stuff that people say about her and have said for so long, like the intensity and like duration of the criticism she has received and like just like the vitriol that's directed at her, I think must be without parallel in terms of public figures in the United States. I mean, I'd be interested to be proven wrong or to be given counterexamples, but I do feel that there's all this sort of like, you know, discussion of her that has so little relationship to who she is or to how she's spent her time over the decades. That just is sort of this. I don't think the people who feel this way believe it, but I believe that it is just this this sense of deep discomfort with like a woman in such a powerful role, and then kind of combined with maybe some like Bill Clinton adjacent antipathy or like antipathy for what he stood for. Uh-huh. And so I do, I think of that, I would guess, but again, I mean, weirdly, I'm like, I'll be very presumptuous in my novel, but I'm kind of a little bit actually trying not to be presumptuous in real life, but I would guess, and I could be mistaken, that it's almost just this reference to like that cloud of like nastiness and accusation. And there's so many levels of antipathy and accusations against her, which are like, oh, she's corrupt and her, you know, speeches for Goldman Sachs and her blah, blah, blah. And then just stuff that's like, you know, has no basis in reality in terms of, you know, stuff she never did. And it, yeah, it's very weird what a level of like loathing some people have for her. Although I also feel like I always want to say, if I acknowledge that, I feel like it's kind of not acknowledged how widely admired she is and how many people just, you know, think she's great, which I do. I'm one of those people.
When I hear you wrestle with that, I think, and you definitely get to some of this in the novel, I think some of that confusion and antipathy, I think some of that comes from the demands that she mold, and this is what I think political life, you know, demanded, especially when Bill Clinton won the White House, that she kind of mold herself into something that just never felt right, that there was a distance between what people were trying to understand about her and then, you know, kind of the clothes of the first lady she had to put on. I don't mean clothing. I just mean the things she had to do that didn't feel, I guess, authentic to herself or to people that were still trying to figure it out. I don't know. You can hear me just trying to come up with excuses because I can't figure out the widespread antipathy either. Does any of that make sense?
So, I mean, yes, it all makes sense, and I agree. Like, so, I mean, I think it really started when Bill, you know, lost the reelection for governor of Arkansas, and it was like, you know, she sort of had a physical makeover,
yes.
And you know, started going by Hillary Rodham Clinton or Hillary Clinton instead of Hillary Rodham. So it was sort of, you know, and the thing that's also interesting to consider because she's been in the public eye for so long is that there are choices that she made that I think were very sensible. You know, if that's like Arkansas in the late 70s or the early 80s, and that's what's demanded of, you know, the wife of a politician at that time, and that, or like what's demanded of a first lady or someone aspiring to be first lady. And then, you know, 20 years later, maybe something different is demanded that she's
right.
I don't know, like I think we sort of ask something impossible
right.
of female politicians anyway, but then also it's a weird thing to kind of say like, this is what your behavior should be. This is how you should look. And then to say, oh no, actually the rules
yeah.
have changed. And now we want you to be like really candid and like show how fun you are on social media. And it's like, I don't know. You know, like I think that she was, you know, brought up to be sort of guarded as a, like self-preservation mechanism.
You're listening to a conversation that I'm having with writer Curtis Sittenfeld about her new novel, Rodham. It's quite delicious. She's joining us this morning from her home in the Twin Cities. We'll get a look at the latest news, and when we come back, we'll continue our conversation. I'm Carrie Miller, and you're listening to my conversation with Curtis Sittenfeld. She lives in the Twin Cities. She's got a new novel out called Rodham, and we're talking about some of the ideas and the perceptions that influenced the writing of the novel. You create what must have been some really heady days at Yale Law School for Hillary Rodham. So she was challenged intellectually. She just loved the classes and the discussions. She was falling in love with Bill Clinton, and she was marveling that someone so handsome and charismatic and charming was drawn not just to her intellect, but there was this powerful sexual attraction between them. And I got the sense that you felt that that was pretty important to establish in the novel. Why? Why does that make you laugh?
Because we're talking about sex.
Uh-huh.
So I don't know. It's a confusing. I think this is like probably the third time I've said this in this conversation. It's a confusing thing. But so I feel like I do think that they fell madly in love at Yale, and you know she decided to sort of join her life with his and her fortune with his and move to Arkansas. In 1974, even though that wasn't the next logical step for her based on her sort of education and resume at that point. And it's like, you know, so I do think that they really did fall in love and that it wasn't, you know, a sort of intellectual or professional agreement. And so I felt like it was important to show that, like, the novel is written from Hillary's perspective in the first person. And I think that, you know, if you say to a person like, okay, think of the person you were the most in love mm-hmm. with in your life, or the time that you felt the most in love. And if I said to you, during that sort of stretch of time, like, you know, did you know if you had kissed the person or not? Did you know if you had had sex with the person or not? Did you know if you had said, I love you to the person? Like, it's like, of course, you know that stuff. You're very aware of all those little milestones and, you know, like kind of back and forth and signs of interest. And so it's supposed to be written from her perspective. But, I mean, the flip side to all that is then I find myself, you know, having conversations and feeling kind of sheepish. And because it's, and I think readers have different levels where, like, some people are like, ooh, like, I loved that. And, like, it made me understand why she was drawn to Bill. And then some people think, like, this is a little uncomfortable. And, yeah, there's a mix.
I didn't find it uncomfortable at all. I was glad for it for a couple different reasons. A, because I think that trope of this was a, you know, professionalized marriage from the beginning. They both saw what each other could contribute, and this was all about ambition. It was just not true. And the other part of it was, I think Hillary Clinton, here's me projecting onto her, but felt, felt less and less able to channel that true passion and connection that they felt for each other as the infidelity stuff emerged early on, right? And was it okay for a woman to still talk about this deep physical connection too that they had, to be openly in love with somebody who clearly was finding, you know, sexual encounters somewhere else? I think that possibility closes for women when infidelity is on the table. What do you think?
That's interesting. I mean, I don't know. I think, so I'm 44 now, and I think one thing that's interesting for me to think about is, Bill announced that he was running for president when I was a junior in high mm-hmm. school. So it's sort of been, you know, my entire adult life. They've both been part of the, kind of obviously like political scene and cultural scene and whatever. And I think that my view of their marriage is probably much less black and white than it was, you know, when I was in high school or you know, when news broke about his involvement with Monica Lewinsky, where I think that sometimes there's a pretense that marriage is all one way, or like almost like that you either have, I don't know, like a perfect marriage or a broken marriage.
Yeah,
and I don't think it's that binary. And also, I mean, none of us, I guess that she has talked about, you know, that he lied to her about his involvement with Monica Lewinsky, for example. But I also think that they could even, I mean, again, this is total speculation. There's nothing that I read that ever indicated this. But it's like, I mean, we don't know what she's agreed to. We don't know what he's agreed to. Like, we don't really know the kind of conversations they've had inside their marriage. And even we don't know, like, I think that our culture, like, there seems like there's many more conversations about, like, polyamory now, or many, like, I feel like I know people who have polyamorous marriages, and it's not particularly
shocking,
you know, noteworthy or shocking or whatever. Whereas I think, and this could be my own naivete, or it could be changing mores, but I think that 10 years ago or 15 years ago, it might have seemed more shocking to me. So it's like, who knows really what they have made peace with each other? And I also kind of feel like, I mean, and this is where it becomes tricky because they're public figures. Like, if they're okay with it, like, this might seem ironic given that I wrote a novel, but, like, what business is it of ours?
Yeah, that is.
Does that sound, like, totally
hypocritical? It does, yeah. Yeah, it does. No, I mean, I agree with, why should we care? And, you know, there was a lot of discussion about that when the Monica Lewinsky stuff came out. But, you know, that doesn't take into account the human condition. Yes, we care. Because
right, that's true too. I mean, look, I'm, by the way, I am really hypocritical or like contradicting
in all the best ways.
I could have like lots of arguments with myself, with like never even leaving my office. But yeah, like that's true too. That it's like, you know, certainly I am very interested in other people and like their relationship. And it's like the fact that it's none of my business has really never like diminished my interest.
Right. I was curious about whether there's this point in the novel where some of the idealism Hillary Clinton sees in Bill, or I guess experiences herself about Bill, has slipped away, and she asks herself, did I imagine my life would be full of such emotional extravagance? I thought that was a really poignant moment for her character, and I was also curious at that moment whether you felt like you had to understand Bill Clinton as well, if not better, than you had to understand Hillary Clinton to really get to the quality of the connection, and then the way that had to change given who he was and who she was.
Well, you know, it's funny because he was elected president in 1992. He's just been such a feature of my life for so long, and you know, she was like being first lady is obviously, you know, secondary at best to being president. And then, you know, she was senator, but she wasn't my senator. So I actually feel like when I started writing this book, I felt a much more reflexive familiarity with Bill Clinton. And I could literally hear his voice in my head if I tried to. And I don't know that I could hear her voice in my head if I tried to at the beginning. I now can. But I felt like I would say I had to research her more than I had to research him, because he's just, you know, he's sort of, I don't know,
he's kind of ubiquitous.
He's pretty prominent. Yeah. And he has, you know, like if you were inventing characters, he's a very colorful character, and you know, just whether it's like him saying "I feel your pain" or like his husky voice or playing the saxophone, or like he has a lot of quirks that you can kind of grab onto. And I think that she has fewer visible quirks.
I'm Carrie Miller, and you're listening to my conversation with novelist Curtis Sittenfeld. Her new novel is titled Rodham, and it's the fictional treatment of Hillary Rodham Clinton's life. And it asks questions like, what if instead of marrying Bill Clinton and moving to Arkansas, Hillary Rodham had become a legal scholar, she'd become a political activist, she'd eventually gotten into politics on her own terms? You were talking about the voice, being able to hear Bill Clinton's voice in your head and having to kind of reach for Hillary Clinton's. And I was interested in how you got her interior and her exterior voice so accurately, because it reads real to me. And it took me to YouTube to be looking for different venues that she's been speaking in where she's a little less guarded, you know, not on the campaign trail. And I found the Wellesley commencement speech from 2017, where she's acknowledging that, the 2016 election didn't work out quite as she expected. So I thought it'd be fun to listen to this, and then we can hear an excerpt from the novel in which you're channeling her voice. So here she is.
You may have heard that things didn't exactly go the way I planned. But you know what? I'm doing okay. I've gotten to spend time with my family, especially my amazing grandchildren. I was going to give the entire commencement speech about them, but was talked out of it. Long walks in the woods. Organizing my closets, right?
Tell me what you hear in that.
It's so funny. So I literally, during those, I don't know how many seconds it was, I like teared up, and then I like laughed. I cried. I love Hillary. Something that I've thought, I don't even know when I first started thinking this, but I have thought to myself, like, if under very random circumstances, you know, in a parallel universe, like if I were in some fancy setting, which like maybe two nights a year not during pandemics, I find myself in like a fancy setting. and it was, you know, like some sort of conference or blah, blah, blah. And I ended up sitting next to her, and the circumstances or like the biographical circumstances of her life were the same, but she had gone on to be like a university president or CEO of a company, CEO of Target, that I would sit next to her and I would think, oh my God, like, I love this one. Like, I love a strong woman. Or a lot of women who, like, a lot of people might be like, she has a very strong personality. Like, that's my kind of woman. Like, I like, this might sound a little, I don't know, snobby on my part, but I often find professionally successful women very interesting. Like, I feel like they have a toughness, they have a persistence,
yes.
They're smart, like they're hardworking. And I feel like that I would think, oh my God, like she's really interesting. She's had really interesting life experiences. She's tough. She's impressive. She's smart. And then, you know, there's this sort of, like, I just feel like in some ways all of us have like wasted time and sort of shortchanged ourselves by like talking about such dumb things about Hillary for so long, you know, like talking about Whitewater or talking about her haircuts or something. Like, there's been this sort of preposterous conversation. I mean, the Hillary in that speech to me is very consistent with my idea for, like, you know, kind of knowing, funny, self-aware. Like, she clearly has the crowd with her. And yeah, that's my Hillary.
Yeah. So back then to this effort to get the interior and the exterior voice right. I mean, how did you do it?
Well, so I guess there's maybe two answers or 17 answers, but one is that I had first read her memoir, Living History, in 2007, doing research for my Laura Bush novel. So, like, I mean, I've had familiarity with her in her own words for a while, even though I did not ever think I would write a Hillary Clinton novel when I wrote that. But then while I was writing this novel, I read her book, What Happened. There's a podcast that was created by her campaign. I mean, I think technically it was created by the Clinton Foundation, but it was like a campaign podcast created in 2016. It was supposed to be like a window into her presidential campaign. And I didn't even know it existed at the time.
Me neither.
I know. Yeah. But I listened to it, you know, in the last few years. And literally, from the first moments, so it's a very sort of stereotypically podcasty host. It's like a, you know, white man who lives in Brooklyn, whose name is Max, who interviews her. And from the first moments, like, he's up front. Nobody's pretending that it's not kind of produced by her own campaign. And so therefore, there's no ambiguity about, like, it's a pro-Hillary podcast. But because of that, she is very relaxed, and her voice just sounds different. And it makes you realize, it makes me realize, that, like, the overwhelming majority of the time I've ever seen her interviewed by anyone, the person has been sort of adversarial or skeptical. And that can be, like, it doesn't have to be like taking the form of a question. It can just be a tonal thing where it's almost like, oh, Hillary, like, here we go again. You know, she's an inevitable 2016 front runner, even though a lot of people don't like her. Like, it's almost as if the person said that, even though they didn't really say that. But instead, it's almost like a person interviewing her who thinks, like, you're smart, you're interesting, it's so great you're running for president. Like, you care about people, you care about, you know, kids, and you care about, like, poor people and the middle class. And then it's kind of allows her to talk in a much more open way. So in a literal way, I think that podcast helped me hear her voice. And by the way, there's a kind of bonus from her Wellesley 1969 commencement address. There's, like, an episode where you can hear her deliver it, you know, like, sort of in front. It's the kind of, not, I don't know if you use the word footage, if it's audio, but it's from 1969. It's so poignant to hear her as a 21-year-old. Like, it's very moving.
That's the excerpt that I think you were gonna read for us, right? She's been chosen.
I will not deliver the speech, although I actually, there are a few lines from the speech itself, but should I sort of read?
Yeah,
I'll read. This is from, she's just started delivering the speech, and the part that was kind of controversial was the senator from Massachusetts was the commencement speaker, and because she felt that he hadn't properly addressed, like, the turmoil, the sort of, you know, political turmoil and Vietnam and student protests, and so she decided to kind of mention all that stuff explicitly. Are you ready for me?
I'm ready.
Okay. So she's just kind of given, like, a little rebuttal to Senator Edward Brooke. And then she says, I knew I'd do at least a good job delivering the rest of my speech, and maybe a great job. Good I could control, while great was more nebulous and chancy, arising from the feedback loop of energy between me and the audience. But I didn't know yet that my speech, probably due to the extemporaneous part, would cause my classmates to give me a standing ovation. I didn't know that the standing ovation would offend or anger many of my classmates' parents, remaining in some cases a point of intra-family contention for decades to come. My father said afterward, with derision, "You sounded like a hippie up there." And I didn't know that my speech would attract national media attention, including from Life magazine. Yet I clearly remember that I felt the feeling, the focused anticipation, my competence, my loneliness. I understood how I appeared to other graduates and their families, a confident and idealistic young woman standing behind a podium, even as I inhabited my own body, as I was me and could hear my voice, and could hear my voice magnified throughout the quad. The feeling was in the collapse, the simultaneity of how I seemed to others and who I really was. In retrospect, I think what I felt in that moment, I'd felt it before, but never quite so brightly, was my own singular future.
I'm Carrie Miller, and you're listening to my conversation with novelist Curtis Sittenfeld. Her new novel is titled Rodham, and it's the fictional treatment of Hillary Rodham Clinton's life, and it asks questions like, what if instead of marrying Bill Clinton and moving to Arkansas, Hillary Rodham had become a legal scholar, she'd become a political activist, she'd eventually gotten into politics on her own terms? So here's something that I really wrestled with. This is the thing that, you know, once I finished and I wanted to keep thinking about the novel, that I kept turning over, which is, does it make me a bad feminist if I say that I'm not sure she didn't lose as much as she gained in the choices that she made in the novel?
Oh, interesting.
Do you know why I'm asking that?
Sorry, what's the thing you just asked?
I said, do you know why I'm asking that?
No.
like...
Oh, you mean like is her life on the whole better for having said, for having said no to Bill Clinton?
Yeah, like which life, the one that she's lived or the one that you imagined, made her most fulfilled?
I don't know. I think that's a great question. And that, so something that I kind of feel like you know, some people have described this book as like a feminist revenge fantasy, and I say thank you, but I do. I feel like you could think, if I said I wrote a novel about Hillary that imagines her not having married Bill, and you might think that I hate Bill, or like I think that was like the great mistake of her life. And I think Bill Clinton is, you know, very, very complicated, and complicated is actually generous and euphemistic. I mean, it's certainly, he's accused of sexual assault. But knowing what she knew in 1975, if he had wanted to marry me, I would have married him and I would have moved to Arkansas. Like, it's not, I don't think to myself, how could she have made that choice, or what was she thinking? Like, I understand perfectly what she was thinking, or I, you know, at least hold on to the illusion that I understand perfectly what she was thinking.
Yeah, and then without, you know, going into too much detail to ruin the suspense of the novel, I ended it thinking, well, she got a lot in Curtis's fictional treatment, but she also lost a lot. And in her real life, she got a lot. And she also lost a lot. I'm not sure how it stacks up.
I agree completely. I mean, I do think that it's possible. Like, I know some people think the idea of soulmates is a little bit ridiculous. And I actually think it's kind of romantic. I mean, again, I have mixed feelings. I don't know if I fully believe in it, but I want to, and I do think it's romantic. And insofar as it exists, I do think that they probably qualify, that Bill and Hillary do find something very specific in each other that would be very hard for them to find in other people. And like, I actually think it speaks, I mean, I don't know, this is such a complicated topic. It might be like, you know, why I chose to like grapple with it in a novel, but in some ways I think it reflects well on him that he wanted to marry her, and you know, that he wanted to marry such a strong, ambitious woman, even though I'm not sure in the long run that he was, you know, a positive force for her ambitions, but I don't think he unequivocally wasn't.
I had the same impression. Like, I like what that says about, you know, this young Bill Clinton, that he sees her for as unique as she is, and you know, he doesn't fall prey, well, at least at that point, to, you know, that era's standard for who should be at your side, right? He knows he's bucking the trend in some ways.
Yeah. Or he knows that he's, you know, bringing someone back to Arkansas who might have like a tougher, you know, path to acceptance by people there than someone else.
Right. And that says something good about him in that moment.
I agree. I agree completely.
And then not in many others. So, Curtis, this has been wonderful. Thank you so much. Boy, I could talk to you for another hour.
This has been a super
wonderful.
I feel like this is. Yeah, thank you for the excellent question.
For sure. I thought we could close with a song that became associated with Hillary Clinton's campaign, and Katy Perry actually sang it for her at the Democratic National Convention. So thank you. Thank you very much. And this may make you tear up, too.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm already anticipating that it will. Thank you.
I won't just survive. Oh, you will see me thrive. Can write.
Heard a recording of a live radio show from NPR News. You can add your voice to the discussion by calling in at 800-242-2828 or tweeting us at Kerri, K-E-R-R-I, NPR. To hear more conversations like this, subscribe to our podcast. And thanks!